Welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and Web Yeshiva. We are forging on in our study of The Lonely Man of Faith, Rabbi Soloveitchik's masterful essay. We're about to start the sixth chapter. There he is. There's Rabbi Soloveitchik right now, or at least his picture. And again, my apologies for missing last week's class. The Shiva Osir Batamuz got the better of me. Here we go. Hold on a second. Okay. The truly real and community were all things that, for those of you that are joining us anew, we're in the sixth chapter of this important essay, Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay, The Lonely Man of Faith. You can get the audio or the audio video archives of the past sessions if there's something that you want to catch up with, or I'll be happy to stay online with you afterwards to get you up to speed if there's something that's confusing, or if you're lacking something that, that you missed in a previous session. But in the meantime, let's just try to roll with the punches. I, thou, he. Adam the second forms community. This is by way of review. Adam the second forms community. When he does so, he forms community with his fellow man, men. Again, apologies for the gendered language of an essay written over 45 years ago. God himself enters as a member of that community. What does that mean? So Rabbi Soloveitchik goes on to explain that even though, as we said before, the man of faith is provoked, like Adam the first, the man of faith being Adam the second, the Adam, the typology that's depicted in the second chapter of Sefer Bereishit, as opposed to Adam the first, that topology, majestic man, lone man, but not lonely man, of Genesis 1. The man of faith is provoked, like Adam the first, by the cosmos about which he is inquisitive. The covenant, not the cosmos, provides him with an answer to his questions. Adam the first, the scientist, the explorer, the vikivshuhaist, the subduer of nature. Pardon me. Sees the cosmos, sees the universe, sees the created world, and feels compelled to seek out new life and new civilizations, to go out and to boldly go where no man has gone before, to Vikivshuha. I've told you before, Rabbi Soloveitchik himself was I wouldn't say he was a fan of Star Trek. I mean, I'm pretty sure he never went to one of those Star Trek conventions, and I'm positive that he never wore Spock ears. But he apparently enjoyed watching Star Trek from time to time. And the whole essay is fraught with the language of the mid-1960s of the space race. I've mentioned this before. There's actually a really good Rabbi Soloveitchik and Star Trek story, but I can't spare the time to tell it to you now. So anybody that's interested, I promise, at the end of the class, I'll tell that story for anybody that wants to stay late. You'll just have to remind me. The covenantal confrontation is indispensable for the man of faith. In his longing for God, he is many a time disenchanted with the cosmic revelation and lives through moments of despair. Naturally, he is inspired by the great joy experience when he gets a glimpse of the truly real. The truly real. Now, I don't know what the Rav meant by this truly real, capital T, capital R, but the emet, the reality hiding behind the magnificent cosmic facade, the big meaning, the big message, that's hidden between the lines of the cosmos. The cosmic facade, the mask that creation presents us with, but embedded underneath it is the truly real. However, he is also tormented, the man of faith, by the stress and exasperation felt when the truly real seems to disappear from the cosmic scene. That meaning, the matters of great import, the real meaning, which hides itself behind the mask of the cosmos, it gets lost. It evades us. It disappears. Sometimes we miss the meaning for the message. We get distracted. We get spiritually distracted from the truly real. Of course, God speaks through His works. Hashemayim Mesaprim Kvod Kael. It's Pasuk in Tehillim, chapter 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Yet, let me ask, what kind of a tale do the heavens tell? When we say that we can understand God by looking at the created world, and I'm sure each of us has had some kind of experience, or at least I hope each of us has had some kind of experience, when, you know, usually it happens when we get out of our day-to-day. You know, I imagine, Sherry lives in Maui. Where's Sherry? Sherry, you live in Maui, right?
Right.
So it's really pretty there, right?
It's spectacular.
And mm-hmm. Would you say that you're able to maintain, how many years have you been living there?
10.
Would you say that you're able to maintain on a daily basis the kind of awe and wonder and inspiration that comes from nature the way that you did when you were first there? Wait. I'm getting some static there. Can you... Sherry, we were getting some static from you. Could you... I didn't catch that. I'm going to unmute you again. Let's see what happens. No, I muted you again. Sherry, I'm sorry. Hello? I muted you again. There must be something wrong with your mic. Maybe you can type what it is you wanted to say. Sorry. Now, Sherry and I didn't practice this before. This was completely ad-libbed. But, okay, so she claims that she actually does. But most people, would you admit that you're an exception to the rule? Most people, at a certain point, probably become, I don't want to say jaded, but it's difficult to maintain that same kind of wonder. So those of us that live in more, garden variety settings, most of us probably don't feel that sense of wonder on a daily basis by encountering nature. But when we get out of our routine and we go someplace else, we can, you know, get that kind of creation. We can get that kind of inspiration. A few years ago, I was at Mitzpeh Ramon. Mitzpeh Ramon is like the Grand Canyon of Israel, you know, like everything in Israel. We have everything that we have every place else, just on a smaller scale. So the Mitzpeh Ramon is down in the Negev. It's a large crater, and it's very beautiful, and it's down in the desert. And we were there on the night of a full lunar eclipse. And down at Mitzpeh Ramon, there's an observatory, a space observatory. What do they call that? A planetarium. And there's a big telescope. I don't know how it compares to the international scale, but it's, you know, that's the Israeli Planetarium down there. And because all of the people that live in the small town of Mitzpe Ramon are really into that, on special occasions, they have a self-imposed blackout where they shut off all the natural ambient light, all the natural electric light. And we were out there. It was a clear, you know, a cloudless night. You're out in the desert, so there's not so much pollution. There's a full eclipse of the moon, so there's no moonlight. And you see billions and billions and billions of stars. What we in the modern world, at least most of us, are no longer accustomed to seeing. I imagine that, I'm guessing some other, let us know if you've had similar experiences. But in the modern world, because of the presence of electric lights and the fact that we, most of us live in cities and pollution and all these things, we no longer encounter the nighttime sky in the same way that people in antiquity did. And you can literally see the Milky Way, which we don't generally, you know, get to see on a daily basis. And you can understand why ancient man believed that the stars control your destiny. Now, that was a mistaken belief back then, but when you lived in a world where that was what you saw every night, you understood why they were convinced that the heavenly firmaments exercised such a strong control over events down here, because it's truly awe-inspiring. So on occasion, you can go out and experience something like that, whether it's in the down in the Negev, or it's on Maui, or it's in, you know, the Scottish Highlands, or wherever it is. The Rav is asking, Hashemayim Mesaprim Kvodel, the heavens declare the glory of God, that nature itself serves to tell a tale about something. But what kind of tale do the heavens tell? Is it a personal tale addressed to someone specific? Or is it a tale which is not intended for any audience? Do the heavens sing the glory of the Creator without troubling themselves to find out whether someone is listening to this great song? Is it a tree falling in the forest? The tree falls whether or not anyone's there to hear it. Or are the heavens trying, is nature, heavens here being a metaphor for the natural created world, is there a message embedded in that glory that we're meant to hear, that we're meant to understand, that we're meant to be educated by? Or are they really interested in man, the listener? I believe that the answer to this question is obvious. If the tale of a heavens were a personal one addressed to man, then there would be no need for another encounter with God. Since God, in his infinite wisdom, arranged for the apocalyptic covenantal meeting with man, we may conclude that the message of the heavens is at best an equivocal one. So despite however inspiring it may be, despite how, and sincerely so, and despite however moving it may be, and despite the degree to which the encounter with natural wonder can itself be a force for coming to a love of God, which the Rambam is really quite clear about, nevertheless, the message God is trying to communicate to us, says the Rav, does not come through nature. The message comes through the apocalyptic covenantal meeting. What's the apocalyptic covenantal meeting? Where does that take place? Where does that meeting with God take place? Yes. Deborah writes, Debbie, you wrote that to me privately. I don't know if you meant that for everyone. It comes at Har Sinai for the Jewish people. It's important to note that this essay is not specifically talking about the Jewish faith, but the faith experience in general. So it comes in a particularistic way for us at Har Sinai, with the giving of the Torah, but it also comes in communication between man and God. And the Rav will now expand this idea. What does it mean to communicate in both directions between man and God? As a matter of fact, at the level of his cosmic confrontation with God, man is faced with an exasperating paradox. On the one hand, man beholds God in every nook and corner of creation. Right? It's not just Maui, by the way. If you live in... I grew up in suburban New Jersey where we could smell the bouquet of the Exxon refinery. Even there, you could see God's hand in every nook and corner of creation. And on the contrary, it's no challenge to see the hand of God when you're standing in Maui. It's a challenge to see the hand of God when you're in a much more, a less magnificent setting. To see it in the flowering of a plant, in the rushing of the tide, in the movement of one's own muscle, when you think about the complexity of, if you're looking in the camera, right? When you think about the complexity of this movement, of my ability to do this, just if my ability just merely to wiggle my little finger, to say nothing of my ability to do this, which, you know, despite some examples of chimpanzees that can, you know, splatter some paint on a canvas, but yet none of them sitting for however long in front of a typewriter still have not yet produced three words of Shakespeare. That's really quite remarkable. And my ability to wiggle my pinky like this is in some ways even more majestic than the mountains of Maui, the stars of Mitzpe Ramon, the Mississippi River, or Mount Everest. As if God were at hand, close to and beside man, engaging him in a friendly dialogue. And yet, the very moment man turns his face to God, he finds him, God, remote, unapproachable, enveloped in transcendence and mystery. And here's the paradox, that we can sense God in creation. We spoke about this a number of weeks ago, an idea that the Rav spoke about elsewhere, the sense of eminence, of God, of imminence, of God being close, looking over our shoulder, feeling his hand resting on our shoulder, as it were, in times of need, of him being very close, that we can communicate with him, we can approach him. Recently we watched A Fiddler on the Roof with our kids, which is just a great movie. But and there's so much about it which captures something about a world that was lost. There are other things about the film which are problematic and not only don't capture something but misrepresent something. That's a different conversation. But the idea, which is, already there in Shalom Aleichem, of Tevye in ongoing dialogue with God, that everything that happens in his life, from his horse going lame to his daughter getting married to this trouble in the town, and he's looking up and he's having this kind of ongoing conversation with God in a very intimate kind of way, in a way that's much more intimate than what we think of as prayer. That we can do that, but then on the other hand, sometimes you turn to look for him, and he's gone. The very moment man turns his face to God, he finds God remote, unapproachable, enveloped in transcendence and mystery. Did not Yeshayahu behold God, Ram v'nisa, exalted and enthroned above creation, and at the same time, v'shuyav mle'im et ha'echal, train of his skirts filling the temple, whatever that is, whatever that metaphor is. But it shows that on one hand, in the same pasuk, Yeshayahu chapter 6 verse 1, Isaiah 6:1, look up the pasuk. It's a description, a metaphorical description, obviously, that God is far and remote and distant, but at the same time, he is present and near. The great universe, from the flying nebula to one's most intimate heartbeat. Right. Where is God? Well, God is there between each heartbeat, but he's also out there in the stars. And he's nowhere at the same time, meaning he's not in the physical world. Did not the angels sing, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvakot, Malo, Kol Haaretz Kvodo, holy, 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 transcendent, 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 Rachok, 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 beyond, beyond, beyond. What is Kadosh? What is Kedusha? When we say, this is the verse we say in Kedusha, in davening. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Holy, holy, holy. So like holy, to translate Kadosh with the word holy is to take, you know, one word that I don't understand and to substitute it for another word I don't understand. What does it mean to be holy? What does it mean to be Kadosh? Well, what's in Hebrew, what's the opposite of Kadosh? What's the opposite of Kadosh? No, the opposite of Kadosh. Common. Well, how would you say it in Hebrew? Hamavdil ben Kodesh le Chol. I mean, we use the term Chol in English to mean like the opposite of, to mean like a weekday, right? There's Shabbat and there's Chol. Right? But chol in the sense of common. So like sand is called chol, al svat hayam. Why is sand called sand? Because even though if you put it under a microscope, you can see that each grain of sand is, you know, infinitely interesting. But in reality, it's just common. It's just out there. You want sand. You can always get it. There's nothing distinct about it. Kadosh is the opposite. Kadosh means separate. So that when we recite on Friday night, when we recite Kiddush, we are separating Hamavdil. We are separating out in this island, this vast island of time, or this vast continuum of time, we're separating out one day and making it distinct. And making it distinct. Kiddushin, which is the expression that means marriage, that when we say that a man is mekadesh a woman, he says, like, there's all these women in the world, and they all exist in one category, meaning they are separate from him. But when a man is mekadesh his wife or a woman, It's not just that he's sanctifying this relationship, but he is designating her, this relationship becomes designated as special or unique, and it's distinct from the relationship that these people now have with everyone else in the world. Kedusha means separate, but in order for something to be separate, it has to be set aside. It has to be not in the same plane as everything else. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. God is holy, holy, holy. He is transcendent. He is beyond, beyond, beyond everything. He is far, far away. But yet he is also Hashem Tzvakot Melo Kol Haaretz Kvodo. Here's a poetic translation. He resides in every infinitesimal particle of creation, and the whole universe is replete with his glory. Melo Kol Haaretz Kvodo. The whole world is full of his glory. So God is both, paradoxically, he is both very distant, far away, and very close, very intimate. In a different essay about prayer, Rabbi Soloveitchik shows how the Amidah is playing off of this theme, that it's bouncing back and forth between addressing God in the intimate and in the remote. In short, the cosmic experience is antithetic and tantalizing. It exhausts itself in the awesome dichotomy of God's involvement in the drama of creation and his exaltedness above and remoteness from this very drama. This dichotomy cancels the intimacy and immediacy from one's relationship with God and renders the personal approach to God complicated and difficult. Well, how can we have a close relationship with something that's far away? God as the cosmic ruler is beheld in his boundless majesty, reigning supreme over creation, his will crystallized in the natural law, his word determining the behavioral patterns of nature. He is everywhere, but at the same time above and outside of everything. When man who just beheld God's presence turns around to address himself to the master of creation in the intimate accents of the thou, that's a reference to what the points he made in the previous chapter, he finds the master and creator gone, enveloped in the cloud of mystery, winking to him from the awesome beyond. He was just here a second ago. I just felt his hand on my shoulder. But now he is beyond, 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 and I can't access him. There's a lovely passage in the Al Hatshuva, in the Isha Halacha, in the Isha Halacha, in the Halachic Man, where Rabbi Soloveitchik describes, from a Hasidic perspective, ironically, what Tkiat Shofar is meant to be. That Tkiat Shofar is the call from beyond. You know, that sometimes you can't get the message through. That there, even prayer, and shortly in The Lonely Man of Faith, we're going to get into a discussion of prayer. But sometimes prayer, because God is so far away, you feel you can't accomplish anything. You can't communicate. You can't overcome that. You can't bridge that distance. And the Tkiat Shofar is this kind of this call from beyond. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I had the chance to go away on a trip. We were scholars in residence on a cruise to the Greek islands. We were actually in Athens right before all of that trouble started there. And we have three kids at home. Our youngest is gonna turn four at the end of this week, actually. And they stayed with my mother-in-law. my father-in-law, Zichrono Levracha, my wife's father, passed away about 2 years ago. While we were away, we had very limited phone access and almost no internet access, actually. But once we ducked into some place and we called home just to check that everything was okay. My mother-in-law gets on the phone and she hands the phone to our almost four-year-old. And she says to him, "It's Abba." But instead of "It's Abba," he thought she said, "It's Saba." Instead of saying, "It's your father," he thought she said, "It's your grandfather." And he gets on the phone and he says, "Saba! I thought you were dead!" Well, I mean, you know, it's a very funny story, but it's, and very touching. But if you think about it, only a child could think such a thing, but imagine that's the way it was. Like, imagine you think somebody you think is dead. Somebody's dead. They're remote. They're distant. They're cut off. There's no phone call. There's no email address. There's no nothing. You can't get there. You can't reach them. They're just beyond. They're in a different realm. Imagine once a year you could make a 2-minute phone call. Can you imagine what that would be like? All year long, you'd be building up to those 2 minutes. So a little bit, that's what Tkiyat Shofar is. That's what blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah is. That once a year we can shout across the void and communicate with sound what we sometimes can't get through with words. So sometimes we feel they're close, and sometimes we feel they're far away, we can't get to them. Therefore, the man of faith, in order to redeem himself from his loneliness and misery, must meet God at a personal covenantal level, where he can be near to him, to God, and feel free in his presence. Now again, remember, redemption, and we've talked about this before, redemption here doesn't, we're not talking about an apocalyptic sense. We're not talking about redemption in the sense of messianic redemption. We're talking about the solution to the problem of the loneliness of the lonely man of faith. Abraham the knight of faith, according to our tradition, sought and discovered God in the starlit heavens of Mesopotamia. Yet he felt an intense loneliness and could not find solace in the silent companionship of God, whose image was reflected in the boundless stretches of the cosmos. Here the Rav is referring to the notion of which the Rambam describes in the Mor Nevuchim, in the Guides to the Perplexed, that God, that Abraham came to the knowledge of God, and there are different versions in the Midrash. When did Abraham come to the knowledge of there being one God, and how did he come to the knowledge? So this idea that Abraham came to the knowledge by looking at the world, by looking at the created world, by looking at the order in the universe, and understanding that, you know, kind of like the clockmaker theory, that you look at a watch, the complicated piece of machinery. Once, when the metaphor was coined, a watch or a clock was the most common and best metaphor for a complicated piece of machinery. Now we have many more things. Nobody imagines that a rocket ship, just accidentally all the pieces happen to land together and fit together in that way, and it works. So since you can't imagine that a watch, you know, the pieces just fell together and it works and it keeps time and it's precise and it's accurate by accident. So you understand there must have been a watchmaker. So you look at the universe and you see the harmony in design, and you understand that there was a creator. Yet he felt an intense loneliness, Abraham, Avram Avinu, and could not find solace in a silent companionship of God, whose image was reflected in the boundless stretches of the cosmos. Only when he met God on earth as father, brother, friend, not only along the uncharted astral routes, did he feel redeemed. Our sages, Chazal said that before Avram appeared, Majestis Dei, Kvod Hashem, the glory of God was reflected only by the distant heavens. And it was a mute nature which spoke of the glory of God. Right? Before Avram Avinu, Avram Avinu's innovation was not that there is only one God in the world, although that certainly, it was that Avram crowned him the God of earth, that is, the God of man, of men, of humanity, meaning that we can have an individual relationship with him, that we can forge, that we can overcome that distance. Majestic man, and here actually, I had sent this out, there's this lovely volume called Worship of the Heart, Essays on Jewish Prayer. It was one of the early volumes. There are now about a dozen of them, these volumes that are put out by the Toras HaRav Foundation, posthumous works that have been put out by Rabbi Soloveitch, meaning Rabbi Soloveitch's works put out posthumously, either essays that he wrote that weren't published or transcripts of talks that had not been made available. And this is one volume called Worship of the Heart, which is a collection of essays about tefillah, about prayer. It's really a if it's a topic of interest or a concern or trouble to you, I strongly recommend it. So I had sent around, it's on the website, you can download it. Thank you, Alan, for the link. The book is available on Amazon. I had sent around, these are a few pages from an essay there, which are parallel to the ideas that the Rav is talking about here, and how this challenge plays itself out specifically in the realm of prayer. Majestic man, even when he belongs to the group of homines religiosi, religious men, and feels a distinct need for transcendental experiences, is gratified by his encounter with God within the framework of the cosmic drama. Since majestic man is incapable of breaking out of the cosmic cycle, he cannot interpret his transcendental adventure in anything but cosmic categories. Therefore, the divine name of Elohim, which connotates God being the source of the cosmic dynamics, sufficed to characterize the relationship prevailing between majestic man and his creator, addressing himself to him through the cosmic occurrence. Let me just open up. Here you go. Remember, among the differences, the Rav had listed four. No, that's not the one I wanted. The Rav had listed four major differences between the story of creation in the first chapter of Bereshit and the story of creation in the second chapter of Bereshit. Here they are again. If you don't know them by heart at this point, well, you should review. In the first chapter of Genesis, man is created B'tzelem Elohim, in God's holy image. But in the second chapter, man is created, is described as being created Afar min ha'adamah, dirt of the field, a rather lowly description. In the first chapter, Zachar u'Nekeva bara otam, man and female are created simultaneously. The whole story of man creating Adam, Velo tov heyot Adam levado, and it's not good that man should be alone, and then taking a rib and subsequently creating Eve and then bringing them together, that is the story in Genesis 2. But in Genesis 1, the creation of man and female is described as taking place simultaneously. Genesis 1, majestic man is tasked with Vikiv Shuha, to subdue creation, to be the master of creation. Genesis 2, man is tasked La'avdah L'shamra, to guard and preserve the garden and, by extension, creation. And finally, in reverse order, Genesis 1 is told as a story about Elohim. Genesis 2 has Shem Hashem, Yud He Vav He. Now, these two names of God, you know, there are, of course, many different names of God, but these are the two most important. Elohim is a title. Hashem is a proper name. Elohim, hold on a second. Elohim is the God of creation. Hashem, Yud He Vav He, is a personal God. Elohim is the name of God as manifested in the Midat Hadin, the characteristic of judgment. Yud Ke Vav Ke, Midat HaRachamim, the characteristic of mercy. Why is it sufficient for Adam the First to live in a chapter that's only within the framework of Elohim? Well, because that's God as the source of the cosmic dynamic. And that's enough to characterize the relationship prevailing between majestic man and his creator. Because majestic man, Adam the First, encounters God through the created world. However, covenantal man of faith, Adam the Second, craving for a personal and intimate relationship with God, could not find it in the cosmic Elohim encounter. Adam the Second wants more than seeing God through nature. He wants a personal relationship. He wants intimacy. And he had to shift his transcendental experience, kadosh, 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 remote, 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 to a different level, at which the finite I meets the infinite He face to face. This strange communal relationship between man and God is symbolized by the tetragrammaton. Tetra, four, the four-letter name, Yud, He, Vav, He, which therefore appears in the biblical account of Adam the Second. That's the end of the sixth chapter, in which he explains homiletically why we have this distinction between Shem Hashem being, between Elohim in chapter 1 as being sufficient for Adam the First, and Yud He Vav He, God's personal holy name, in the second chapter, which is the description of the man of faith. This is a lengthy footnote to the chapter. I'll skip through part of it. In terms of this level of intimacy and this level of communion between Adam the Second, between the man of faith, or the desired level of communion between Adam the Second, the man of faith, and God. He asks, does the loving bride, in the embrace of her beloved, ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved with a capital B, does the soul does the human soul, when reaching up to the divine, demonstrate that he exists? So asked Kierkegaard sarcastically when told that Anselm of Canterbury, the father of the very abstract and complex ontological proof, spent many days in prayer and supplication that he be presented with rational evidence of the existence of God. As if there is such a thing, rational evidence of the existence. Maimonides' term Leida, the Rambam at the beginning of Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, at the very, very beginning, the first opening paragraph of the Mishnah Torah, of the Sefer Mada, says that we are obliged, Leida Sheyesha Matsui Rishon, which literally translated into English is to say, we are commanded not to believe in God, but to know that there is a God. So this idea that we must know God transcends the bounds of the abstract logos and passes over the realm of the boundless intimate and impassioned experience where postulate and deduction, discursive knowledge and intuitive thinking, conception and perception, subject and object are one. It becomes a unity. What does it mean to know something? Right? Well, in the same sense that the biblical metaphor for relations, for marital relations, for sexual relations is ladat, to know, that man knew Eve. It's not merely a euphemism for to know in the biblical sense. It's not merely a euphemism for sexual relations. It's a metaphor to know something or to know someone is a way to communicate the idea of the very highest level of intimate connection. So knowledge of the divine is similarly a very high level of intimacy. So this idea that, you know, you can prove something, that there are things that for which there are proofs. Well, there are certain things that can't be proved. There are things that can be experienced. Now, here, this question of ontological proof and God, and as I did point out that many people have come to this essay, myself included, under a false premise, or a mistaken premise, I should say. We talk about the lonely man of faith, that it's going to be a kind of guide to the perplexed. It's going to explain, you know, it's a proof for God's existence. That's not at all what the book is about. And indeed, here we see why possibly the Rav thought there couldn't be such a book. But at the same time, the proof of God's existence comes not through rational proofs, but through experiences which are, in fact, cognitive and intellectual, and it comes through analysis, and it comes through study, and it comes through encountering the world, and it comes through gaining that type of intuitive intimacy of the divine. Let me take a look at some of these chats here. That is what Adam the Second achieves in this communal, in this relationship that he forms, in which God is a partner to the relationship. Sherry asks, but Tzelem Elokim corresponds both to matters in the first creation, the more personal God, and the second creation. Sherry, I'm not sure I understand your question. Can you explain how the communal relationship is symbolized by the tetragrammation? Oh, and it's because Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, there's this notion that the tetragrammation, that the Shem Hashem, is a personal name as opposed to a title. That Elohim Acherim, other gods, the name, we're careful not to pronounce these names outside of the context of reciting Psukim or or davening, but the name. Oh, I'm sorry, one second. The name Elohim is a title for judges or for gods with a lowercase g, meaning false gods. But even the Bible itself has to make reference to these other gods whom we don't believe in, because sometimes in the context of reporting what was going on in the ancient world, we have to describe that these people worshipped false gods. So Elohim is technically a title, which is not exclusive to Elohim with a capital E, meaning our God, right? It is also that, but it is assigned also to sometimes it means judges, like a judge, a panel of judges, of human judges, is referred to as Elohim, because in a certain sense they're functioning in the same capacity, or they're functioning as delegates of God in this world. So Elohim or Elohim, when referred to God with a capital G, is a title. But Yud He Vav He is a personal name. That's his personal name. Obviously, it doesn't mean the same as saying that my personal name is Jeff or that your personal name is Sherry. But that's why that's a more intimate, private, and Elohim being a title is like the same way that if you live in England and you say Your Majesty, you're referring only to, you know, that lady whose picture is on the money and the postage stamps, but she does have a personal name. It's hard to imagine what it's like, you know, if you have that kind of relationship where you can refer to her by her personal name. I wonder what, like, her family actually really calls her. I mean, they must have, like, some kind of nickname. They all these royals, they all have some kind of nickname or something. But that's the idea, and that's why for Adam the First, it's just Elohim, and for Adam the Second, it's Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, because Adam the Second tries to forge ahead with this personal relationship. Yes. No. It's not that we pass over and join him there. It's that God is simultaneously Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. That he is distant, 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 transcendent, 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 far, far away. Part of him we're never going to get to. But on the other hand, he opens himself up to the personal relationship, and on that plane, we have a chance. Okay. So that's the sixth chapter. We'll go ahead next time and with the seventh chapter. I'll send it out. You can read it on your own. And we will continue next week. I'll stay online in case anyone has any questions.